Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's podcast, I'm chatting to both our first Irish guest and our first fellow Murphy to be on the show. That is writer-director Paddy Murphy, who tells us all about his latest film, The Perished. During our conversation, we talk about the initial inspiration behind the film, the creature effects on the film, and how the movie tackles the societal attitudes in Ireland around the issue of abortion. We also talked to him about the film's world premiere at Frightfest and the reactions he received both from audiences and the cast who had not seen the film previously to this. You will get all of that and a whole lot more in just a sec, but before that, I would just like to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Radio Public, all those places. Anything you could do would be greatly appreciated. It keeps us going. It puts the numbers up. It's all good. But now, on to the interview with Paddy. Hi, Paddy. Welcome to New Horror Express. It's good to have you on the show.
Hi, Scott. Thanks so much for having me on.
So we're here to talk about your new movie, The Perished. So for listeners, can you give a little synopsis of what The Perished is about?
I can indeed. The Perished is a supernatural drama horror film set in Ireland, kind of around about 2 years ago when things were probably at Ireland's bleakest in a long time, just kind of with the attitudes towards women's rights. And that's kind of what the whole film is about. It's about a young woman who finds herself with an unplanned pregnancy that, like, she's done everything to avoid being in the situation, but sadly she's there. Her boyfriend doesn't know and breaks up with her. Her parents are horrified and kick her out of the house. But through all this, she basically has to make the hard decision that she needs to go to the UK and have an abortion, which is a very harsh reality that a lot of Irish women did go through. And so then when she comes back from that experience, she feels totally isolated and shamed and stigmatized. So she ends up going to an old abandoned country house with her best friend to try and recover. But little do they know that the house sits on top of a mass baby grave, which is yet again another sad truth of Ireland, something that really did happen. And basically she starts to hear things and see things, and she's not quite sure whether that's a side effect of what she's going through or whether there is something more to it.
And I didn't realize that those things stayed open for so long, and until, you know, seeing it at the start of your movie, that, you know, like those kind of quote unquote mothers and babies homes were like only 1996 that stopped happening.
No, it is. It's crazy to believe that, as I say, the last one closed in 1996, which, I mean, I was 12 or 13 at that time. In my head, these were things that existed long before my time, you know, in the 50s and 60s. And then kind of hearing, you know, talking to my mother about it and talking to, you know, some other people of maybe the generation just above me, it's just crazy how little we understood or knew what was actually still happening in the country. But then as well as that, obviously what comes with that is a lot of the religion and stigma, or the stigma through religion. And that's kind of been something that's ebbed on well beyond the closure of those places. And it's still, even kind of in a post-referendum Ireland, is still there.
So was the movie, your first inspiration for writing the movie, was that directly inspired by the abortion referendum?
The funny thing is, no, because I started writing it in September of 2017, and it was actually before any announcement of the referendum had happened. There was obviously a big push within the country for a repeal referendum to take place, but it hadn't been announced yet that the new government was going to do that. So I think when I started writing it, it was very much set in a contemporary Ireland where this was something that was illegal and there was no end in sight, which actually some people kind of joked to some extent that, like, when the referendum came up, they were like, is this going to, like, ruin your film now? Like, because if this goes through or not, does that affect, like, the outcome of your film? And I'm like, I personally want to see it go through, like, because I think it'd be best for everyone. But, like, I kind of get what you're saying. it could change things up massively, but it really hasn't, because attitudes don't change that quickly, whether it's voted in or not. So, I mean, despite the fact that there has been the repeal referendum movement was voted in here, there has been no real legislation. So, I mean, we're still in pretty much the exact same position we were when I started writing it.
Oh, so it's still a real grey area then?
Yeah, there's, as I say, the government has obviously acknowledged that, yes, we want, like, the referendum was, you know, a yes vote, and so it should be something that's handled, but, like, it's still such a hotbed issue that it feels like no one actually within government is willing to kind of step up and take the reins of it and say, okay, well, let's write some legislation and get this thing sorted. Everyone's still a little bit touchy on it and staying back from it. I think there's a lot of fear that there'll be similar kickback to what they saw in the States, you know, people standing outside picketing places, or God forbid, like, people attacking doctors and things like that. So I think there is a fear of that within government, definitely.
But I mean, it does seem like it went in with quite a positive majority. Like, it wasn't like Brexit. It wasn't like, again,
Yeah, I think there was definitely less well, I was going to say there's less deception, but to be fair, part of the reason the Perished came through redrafting the Perished, what I ended up happening was it was very much probably more within my own views in the first early drafts. It was very much a kind of a bit more of a pro-choice film. And then as the referendum went on, I saw that both sides, both the pro-choice and pro-life sides, were so aggressive in their behavior that I started to think, like, and I talked to people on both sides and saw, like, why somebody might think one way and why somebody else might think the other way, but those two people that I was talking to weren't speaking to each other, so they were just like, they're the enemy and they're wrong and I'm gonna shout them down because they're wrong, and nobody was kind of actually going, like, just let's talk for a minute and see, you know, why you've landed where you've landed. And so as I was writing it, that became actually probably much more what the top level of the film is definitely kind of the bigger issues of, you know, abortion and the mother and baby homes and the mass baby graves, all these very big social issues. But the more important, like, foundation of the film for me is that kind of miscommunication where people won't talk or empathize or listen and just shout each other down. And that just ends up, in my opinion, making everything fall apart, which is kind of what happens in the film.
And that does seem to be, social media seems to generate that as well, and there does seem to be various things, whether it's Brexit or it's Trump or it's, you know, or that, you know, like, where everybody's just kind of like, you're the enemy.
Yeah, no, it's sorry, I what was that? Sorry, I just lost the connection there for a sec.
Oh no, I was just saying that there seems to be a lot of these debates that have come up in recent years that are very divisive, and people are one side or the other, and the you know, like,
oh, true, yeah, like you say, in the US you have obviously Trump, and then in the UK we've had Brexit, in Ireland we had the referendums, and then, I mean, even if you go to France, there's been a lot of kind of, you know, issues there. It does definitely seem to be something that is a global situation at the moment, and as you say, I think social media is a big part of that, because it creates a situation where people can kind of rally together in their opinion, and then you create a thought bubble where the only people that you surround yourself with are people that share your views. So you're like, well, my view must be right because all these other people think so. And yeah, so I think, as I say, for me, that was the core crux of why I wanted to make this film as inclusive of kind of different viewpoints as possible. Obviously, I knew the film was going to hinge on a central performance of the character that we're going to presumably most empathize with, But at the same time, I didn't want any other characters to necessarily come across as like being just absolutely villainous or horrible, or, you know, although the mother gives that a good run for her money.
The character is pretty nasty. You don't really have any shred of sympathy for her.
And it's really weird, because I remember when I first screened the trailer in Glasgow, Fright Fest Glasgow in February, I went out for a smoke afterwards because I was kind of just recovering from the experience of showing the trailer for the first time. And when I was out the front just having a smoke, I was chatting to a girl who had an Irish mother. And she was like, that was my mother. She was like, that was the level of fear that she would instill in me. Like, if I was to come home and tell her that, like, she would absolutely lose the plot. So it was crazy that so many people were able to look at it and say, like, that she was a real character, as one-dimensional as she is, or seems.
Well, that must have felt like an achievement, though, like, because to see something, for the character to resonate so strongly with somebody from Ireland, from the.
Yeah, I think a huge part of that comes down to Noelle Clark and her performance, because, I mean, you know, when you write something, you hope that it'll come through the way you imagine, but it's always going to be down to that performance on the day. And I feel like Noelle just brought this fire to that character that maybe wasn't even necessarily there on the page. And what's really funny is Noelle is like the sweetest, nicest person you could ever meet, and she's a great mother and not at all like her character. But I think that's why she was able to get right in there, was because maybe it was a little bit of fantasy role play, like getting to be the mother that you never want to be.
In terms of the casting, in terms of the actors, when you were writing the movie, did you have any people in mind? I know the central character, Sarah, is played by Courtney Keon, and I know you've worked with her a few times before. So how many of the characters did you have a specific actor in mind, and how many was just like you auditioned?
I mean, barring the role of Sarah, we auditioned for every other part. But yeah, with the character of Sarah, I kind of knew from the second I started writing it that I would like for Courtney McKeown to play the part, but I wasn't sure if she would want to. So we sat down and we discussed the film, and she actually, you know, as I was writing the script, came to me with some notes, like, especially about some of the kind of, I suppose, the medical stuff to do with the procedure of having an abortion. She kind of gave me some information on that. And there was people that kind of said to me, would you not try getting, you know, a big actress and all this kind of stuff? But I just knew that because it was an issue that Courtney really cared about, I knew she could get into that character and give it everything. So I was kind of keen to stick with her from day one. And then the rest of the cast, Noelle came on to do a concept trailer with us when we were trying to raise funding for the film. And in the concept trailer, she just blew me away. So even though we knew we were going to be auditioning for the part of Elaine, she had left a lasting impression from that. So it was kind of a natural casting choice with her. And I think probably I had worked with Fia Kunz, who plays Shane, before. And just he gave the best audition for that part. And the same with Lisa Terrell, who plays Rebecca, his sister. And I think the real revelations of the film for me were Paul Fitzgerald, who plays David, the best friend. I'd never worked with Paul before. He was someone I'd always been super eager to work with. And I just think he was one of the absolute standouts of the film. He brings this warmth to the film that if it wasn't there, I think it would just be way too bleak. And then Oisin Robbins, who plays the role of Nigel, Rebecca's fiance, he was yet again, he sent in a self tape. From the second I saw it, I was like, this guy's great, we need to have him in the film. And the same with the dad, Connor Lambert, that was a self tape. And I didn't know that Connor had been in loads of big Irish movies, TV shows, all this stuff. He'd been in like Intermission, which was a big favorite film of mine. He was in Ripper Street and all these kind of shows and stuff. And I was kind of glad to not know that, because maybe that would have informed my casting choice, but instead it was just like, no, his self-tape is so good. And then I guess the one of the other casting choices was, of course, the creature performer who would play Killen in the movie. And that was a guy named Stephen Tuberty, who I'd worked with before. And he was definitely my first thought upon writing the script of somebody who could play that part.
And what was, you know, like in terms of how you envisioned the creature in the script and how it is in the movie, how close is that? Is that what you had in your mind's eye when you were writing or developing the movie?
It's incredibly close, which it blows me away because we were working to a fairly limited budget. And when I first came to my special effects makeup supervisor, Becky Tuberty, who I've worked with on I think every film I've done so far, I kind of came to her and told her the basic idea of what I wanted, and she went off and drew up a concept sketch probably while we were on a Skype call, like we were chatting, and I was telling her what I wanted, and it wasn't even, I didn't send her like a written description, we just started talking about it, and she sent me a concept sketch, and I was like, oh my god, yes, this is exactly. Some of the things that changed from that were it had the creature had two extra arms, which just became too complicated to do in practically, and I didn't really want to rely too much on visual effects. I'm a big fan of practical effects and trying to do as much as humanly possible practically. So we ended up kind of spending the next couple of months in pre-production actually testing out a couple of different things, different textures on the creature makeup and suit. And by the end of it, I was super, like when we turned up on set to shoot and we turned all the lights on, and you know, I was actually ecstatic with what I was looking at. I was like, you know, for the budget we were working to, this is pretty impressive. This is like these are the kind of practical effects that were in 80s horror movies that I loved growing up. So whether that could be seen as a plus or a minus, I don't know, that's up to the in the eye of the beholder, I guess.
It is definitely a decent effect. I think it's it works well, and it is a creepy but also kind of cool looking creature. I've seen some other writers refer to like Hellraiser, but also it made me think of the early 80s sci-fi horror Extro.
That's incredible, because yeah, I'm a big fan of Extro, and I think this is the first time that someone has possibly compared it to that, which is great, because I think yet again, that's what I mean, those kind of the special effects in those 80s movies, even like Extro and Hellraiser, it's like we've kind of moved away from a lot of that stuff, but it was damn good stuff, you know, like the stuff Bob Keane was doing in Hellraiser, he was doing with like condoms and KY jelly and rubber, and like he was making these like horrific monstrosities out of like the most limited of two. They didn't have these gigantic makeup toolkits that people have now, so I really spent a lot of time with my makeup artist kind of watching Leviathan and showing her stuff and saying like, really tried to think of it more in this 80s mentality, like you don't have access to all this stuff that we do now, and like how could you make something with these limited resources. And I really think she stepped up to the plate. And like you say, I do think that it holds up well on camera, which is always a scary thing when you're doing any kind of makeup, heavy makeup, especially a creature.
Was that the most complicated part of like kind of prepping the film, the creature effect?
In pre-production, I mean, there was two things. One was getting the right location, because we knew if we didn't get the right location, the right house, it was going to be a very hard film to do kind of production design on, to try and get the right look. So we spent a good bit of time really trying to find the right location, and a lot of, surprisingly enough, a lot of parochial houses weren't too keen on the idea of what we were shooting. I don't know why. I mean, I,
who knows?
Yeah, I can't fathom it. And I mean, I liked them and everything, but like they saw through me. Then we landed on the location we got probably 2 weeks before we started shooting, and it just happened to be exactly what I'd seen in my head, and we literally had very little production design to actually do, because it was so, we just brought in some kind of religious iconography, like statues and paintings and stuff. But the house just looked perfect. So, I mean, location was definitely one thing, but then, yeah, makeup tests. I think we had a makeup test every weekend from, we shot in October, we started October 5th. And I think we started our makeup tests when I got back from Fright Fest that year. So August 2018, And then every weekend from then till October 5th, we were in the office doing makeup tests and seeing what looked good on camera and what looked good under lights. And one thing that proved very interesting was there was these kind of silver patches in the suit that looked really awful in reality. But then when you put lights on them, they ended up looking like kind of bone white. And we were like, holy, that's a really cool mistake. We'll use it. And yeah, even when we moved to color grade, those sections just looked really, it was just a really happy accident. So yeah, we were lucky in that way as well.
I was wondering as well, is kind of 80s horror your favorite horror? Because I noticed, like, while watching the film, that while the kind of dramatic elements, it's a very present day story, and it seems modern. Quite a few of the horror elements do seem quite 80s. We mentioned the creature effect, and also like Sarah's dream sequences where she has like the bloody eyes made me very much think of like Fulci.
Oh wow, cool. Yeah, that's, I mean, I would say like I've grown into being quite a big Fulci fan now. Like when I was younger, I didn't have any idea of who Fulci was, like growing up and stuff. And that's something I've kind of come to learn over the years. But that's an awesome, it's something that, yet again, I didn't really think of, but that's really cool. But what kind of was a huge influence on me going into this film was, I don't know if I could say strictly 80s, because I mean, one of the films that was a huge, definitely in terms of the atmosphere, that the film that I most wanted to kind of be like a spiritual partner to some extent, was Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, which is like one of my favorite all-time horror films. And what I love about it is that sense of dread that just builds and builds and builds steadily throughout the film. And it doesn't necessarily do mad jump scares, and it doesn't necessarily try to scare you at every turn, but you just know the whole way through that something bad is going to happen. And then another film that really, yet again, I didn't see it till maybe probably a year before I started writing the script. So it was probably like 2017, but first time I ever saw it was Peter Medak's The Changeling, which yet again, just this idea of that isolated house. I mean, that's so many horror films, but what Peter Medak did in that film with how he used scares like a bouncing ball, which sounds ridiculous, but then when you see the movie, you're like, holy shit, this is so scary. Like, this bouncing ball is actually terrifying. I really honed in on those kind of mid-70s through mid-80s haunted house films, Burnt Offerings and, you know, things like that, where a lot of it was about grief and trauma and sadness and how that kind of... And actually, one of my favorite films ever is David Cronenberg's The Brood. Just of all David Cronenberg's films, I know he's got an incredible filmography, and you could pick... Everyone could pick a different favorite out of it, and they'd all still be right. But The Brood, for me, is just so terrifying. Just this idea of this woman who can literally create hate babies. Like, that was definitely a inspiration for The Perished as well.
The Brood's a brilliant movie. I mean, yeah, like you say, Cronenberg has a lot of brilliant movies. It is quite rare nowadays, though, that vein of horror, the things like The Changeling and Don't Look Now, that really don't rely on scares, that really rely on just creating this oppressive, foreboding, horrible, skin-crawling atmosphere.
Yeah, and it's interesting because some advice we got when we submitted the film to Fright Fest, and they had some suggestions for the film, some of which we took on board, like just to tighten it up and tidy it up. But one of the suggestions was to remove some of the more comedic elements from the film with Davitt. But I just had this feeling that if I did, I don't think I could watch it. Like, personally, I don't think I could watch something. As much as I love Don't Look Now, that's why I think I'd always applaud Nicholas Roeg, because I don't think I'd be brave enough to just be like, this is going to be effectively like a joyless experience. Because that's what makes that film so good. But it's such a hard decision to make, to be like, this is just going to be just totally oppressive. I did want it to be that in The Perished, every time you get that sense of relief from one of those little moments where Davitt, you know, maybe lifts her up, that you know that right around the corner there is something that's just going to, whether it be a phone call she doesn't want, or, you know, something happening to her in public, and then that stigma and shame coming back. Like, that was kind of the core idea for me was, let's not make it just like bleak from start to finish. Let's punctuate it with these moments of, you know, levity, but then let's kind of drive it right back home that, no, this, you know, living with this stigma and this shame is something you can't get away from. And it's actually the real monster of the film, I guess, is that's what's following her around. And that's what's really hurting her, I guess, is that sense of stigma and shame.
Was it, you talk about that, the comedic elements and kind of having those moments that brighten the film up, so it's not just a completely bleak experience. Was it quite difficult balancing all the different elements? Because on the one hand, you have these little comedic moments. On the other hand, there's a good portion of the film that's effectively just a social realist drama. And then obviously, particularly in the final act, it goes full horror. And was it difficult to find the balance in tone and the balance of just how much of these elements need to be in the movie?
It definitely was. Like, when we completed the film, once we had it shot and we were in the edit suite, our first pass of the film, I think it was coming close to 2 hours. It was like an hour 55 or something. And the order of it is so different from what's there now. It's crazy. Like, if you put them side by side, they're night and day. In that version, the very first appearance of any kind of horror element was 45 minutes into the film. And that was just like seeing a shape in a window, which now comes at, I think, the 22-minute mark. So like, when we got into the edit suite, I remember, I think a lot of filmmakers would be able to identify with this moment, but we were looking at the assembly cut, and I said good luck to my editor, you know, after watching it. I was going home, and in the car, I was just like, oh my God, I've made such a mistake. This is awful. I'm so upset. I can't believe I've made this film and dragged everyone through this. And I really just thought we had made something bad. And on the way home, I thought, no, there has to be like a way. And I started to think about, well, if this came in here and that came in there, and just started to kind of move the pieces around. And that's, I mean, it's a saying that everybody always says, which is that the film is made in the edit. And it was very true of this film. It started to become a case of, we have these, as you say, these different pieces. We have the dramatic, and we have the horror, and then we have some little comedy moments. And it was a case of trying to, in the edit, slot them all into the places where you felt that they would work best. And at the same time, try to keep the pacing moving and never leave it too stagnant, because that was definitely an issue in maybe the first three passes of the film. Even we'll say one of the earliest versions that was submitted to Frightfest was like an hour and 40, and there was still just moments where they were like, do we really need to see this? Do we really need to hear that? Examples of that would be like early in the film, like right in the first kind of 10 minutes, there was a lot more of the parents, Sarah's parents, a lot more kind of them just going about their daily lives. And while it was there to kind of show, oh look, they are a normal family, it was something that you know, didn't need at the end of the day, because with trying to marry these elements, you couldn't spend that long on the drama, because by the time you got to the horror, it would not necessarily be as effective. But yeah, it was a delicate balance. And I mean, some reviews seem to think we did a good job, and some reviews think we didn't, and that's the nature of the business. And I'm very happy with it personally. Like, with it's everything that I wanted to see in a movie, tonally and pacing wise. But I totally understand if people are like, this is weird. Why does it go from a social realist Ken Loach kitchen sink drama to fucking Clive Barker's? Oh, sorry, I swore. To Clive Barker's Hellraiser, like.
It is interesting. Like, in terms of that, did you always envision it in the film as a horror movie? That, you know, yeah. What was it about the genre that you thought, like, yeah, this is the best way to tell this story and not just tell it as a Ken Loach social realist drama?
I think what I've always loved about horror personally is that horror can be used to talk about stuff that people don't feel comfortable talking about. I mean, obviously, the most recent examples of that, as I say, are things like Get Out. But I think it goes way back. And as I say, when you look at kind of 70s horror, I think that was a great era where people were really tackling, and not necessarily horror, but just genre films in general, were talking about bigger issues, but in a way that people, it was subverted underneath underneath the kind of horror film tropes. And people, I keep saying it, but I feel like horror to me is the sugar that makes the medicine go down when you're talking about any kind of social issues. But yeah, I, from day one, the very first scene that I came up with for the entire film was the scene where Sarah is in bed and she has sleep paralysis and something in the corner of the room starts creeping towards her and climbs onto the bed and hugs her. Because I remember I pitched that to my producer. I was like, I just had this idea and it's this. And I explained, I was like, it crawls onto the bed and it like cuddles her. And he was like, oh, that's disgusting. He was like, that's so much worse. He was like, if it just like attacked her or just like, you know, savagely or cut to black, whatever. But like the fact that it like cut, he was like, I don't like that. And so that immediately was the kind of, I was like, oh, I like we can talk, we can. And but then that led to the question of, well, what would do that? What creature would just want to cuddle someone? And that was where I started to look at obviously what was happening here. And I read an article about, you know, the awful mass baby grave in Tuam, which was an issue I wanted to include in the film, but I did not want any direct, I did not want to correlate it with that real world event, because like, I didn't want to set it there or use the name of the place, because I don't want it. We did want to handle it with some sensitivity and not draw any exact real world parallels. And instead kind of just, because Tuam wasn't the only one there, they were all over the country. It was a means to kind of talk about it as it could have been anywhere, you know. It didn't explicitly have to be somewhere that actually existed. But yeah, it was always going to be a horror film, but I think actually it went the other way around in that it started out much more horror and much more body horror, actually. And then it kind of actually became more dramatic as the script, as the drafts kept rolling out.
I take it that must have been a bit of another difficulty as well, of like, you want to tackle these sensitive issues, you want to do it in this way, but you don't want to be too schlocky or sensationalist with it either.
Oh, definitely. I mean, for me, as I say, the biggest thing that I wanted to do was not, as I say, reference any. In an early draft, we did have one line, or in an early version of the film, there was one line where they reference something, a real world issue, real world place. And I wanted that cut immediately just because I felt like people really went through that stuff. And I didn't want somebody to be sitting in the theater and hear the name of the place even and go, oh, like that, you know, that really affects them. I mean, you do want to provoke and you do want people to leave and discuss what you're talking about, or else I feel like, you know, you haven't done your job if you're making something like this. But at the same time, you don't want somebody to literally be hurt by it. That's never what we wanted. And to be fair, early on I did get one or two messages from people kind of saying, oh, are you, you know, from people who had been through, who had had family in mother and baby homes and things like that, and they were a bit unsure about it. But then once I actually explained to them what the creature was, what the film was about, and how, I think one big thing, and I don't know, it's not necessarily a spoiler, but like, I would say for me, the creature is not evil. It's not, and the reason I say that, and it's not a spoiler, is I've never been a fan of the evil, like totally one-dimensional evil monster, because I've always loved the likes of Frankenstein and, you know, even Jason, as weird as it sounds, like they're sympathetic monsters because they've been wronged. Something's been done to them. That's not their fault. It's society's fault, or, you know, it's somebody else has done this to them. And so I wanted to make sure that that was definitely the clearest thing about this creature, this, you know, killing, was that it was not necessarily just a straight out and out monster. It was something that had been deeply, deeply wronged, and was just actually looking for, in a lot of ways, kind of a sense of connection, which is probably another underlying theme of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's not a spoiler to kind of say that in the kind of curve of the film, you know, you do think, oh, this is an evil monster, and then you realize, maybe not, you know, it's more complex than that, shall we say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that was part of why I wanted it to look horrific, because when something looks horrific, you immediately react with, oh, geez, what the hell is that? Oh, no, I don't like that. and like your immediate response is bad. But then I wanted it to look horrific, and then as the film went on, for you to gain an understanding of why it exists and what its motivation really is, and that maybe, you know, it's that kind of what's on the surface, it's kind of hiding something much deeper underneath it. Yet again, like, hopefully the film. Yeah. The tricky one, I'll tell you that. In general, just all these, it was such a film that, like, another thing is that, like, it was so heavy on set. Like, we were all very emotional, like, especially the cast, all the time. But the only way we could deal with that was through some form of levity, like just joking about things or just laughing or just, but then, like, if the actors needed a moment to, like, get into character and get emotional, we would just stop or, you know, stop our laughing and joking or tell people to move outside or move to a different room if they were going to be, you know, messing. But yeah, it was definitely one of the heaviest sets I've been on to date.
How was the shoot of the picture generally? Was it an eventful shoot? Was there any disasters, or did it all go quite smoothly? I mean, obviously it sounds like it was quite heavy. I mean, you're obviously dealing with quite bleak material, so I can imagine that being the case.
Yeah, the lucky thing for us was on our previous feature film, The Three Don'ts, we had been through every possible challenge that filmmakers could possibly get hit with, barring, I don't know, like alligator attacks, I guess. But like, we just literally got hit by so much stuff on that film that I think going into The Parish, we were so much more prepared in every possible way. And it was definitely, in a lot of ways, a much smoother shoot. Maybe I feel that as director more than other people, because on the previous film, I had to do everything myself, like, more or less. Like, I was very much kind of organizing, like, from a production, like, producing capacity. On The Three Don'ts, I was pretty much doing a lot of that, 90% of it. Whereas when it came to The Parish, I had two great producers alongside me, Barry Fahey and Vashon Gill, who stepped up and just made sure that, like, I could just focus on directing and I didn't have to worry about all these crazy minutiae that, when you're worrying about that, you're not looking at the shot or you're not focusing on performance because you're thinking about, oh, I wonder if catering will get here by 2 o'clock, you know? So yeah, it was, I mean, we still had our share of issues. I think every production has to, but I will also say that between all of us, there was an incredible team of problem solvers, people who were just, anything that did happen was like, no, it's okay, we'll do this. And literally any major issues that arose were dealt with very quickly. Even just as an example, there's one scene, it's kind of a surreal dream sequence, and it was originally meant to be filmed by a lake. And on the day, we're like, okay, let's go film at the lake. And then we forgot we live in Ireland and it was November. So like, we looked outside and it was just like pouring down rain. And we're like, okay, we're not going to the lake, guys, which is always an issue here, which is why I always try to write majoritively indoors nowadays. But we ended up going, well, what can we do? And we waited till night that night, and we did that scene at the front of the house. And I actually think keeping it in or around the house was actually better for the film. So just kind of good team of problem solvers made all the difference.
Excellent. I can definitely sympathize. I can imagine, you know, as a Scotsman, you know, I can, I know.
Us Celts, why do we get all the rain? It's not fair. But it's true. Like, yeah, I've on The Three Don'ts, it was almost entire, I think it was like 70% outdoor and 30% indoor. And through that experience, I was like, the next film is going to be 20% outdoor and 80% indoor. And that was kind of the ratio in The Parish. It was vastly, vastly more set inside.
We should just have all the films that are made in Scotland and Ireland just always set indoor.
Well, I remember, it's really funny because, like, we do actually show a lot of exteriors of the house and things like that, but there was a point where I wasn't going to, because I'd watched a thing about Reanimator, which is another favourite film of mine, and yet again, another 80s horror. And they talk about Reanimator, and somebody one of the guys involved said there's no exterior shots in the entire film. And I was like, that's bull. There's definitely exterior shots in the film. I remember them. In my head, I was convinced. And then I went back and rewatched it. And I was like, there's no exterior shots in this film. Like, my brain had filled in the blanks that, like, there must have been. You must see the hospital. You must see the house. But you don't. So there was a point where I was like, do we need the exterior shots? Because Reanimator didn't need them. But no, we went back and got some B-roll footage of the house. And I do think it makes a difference because the house is as much a character as Sarah or David or Killen.
Actually, I hadn't thought about that. I was while you were saying that, I was just going over Reanimator in my head, and I was like, yeah, you just go from the university, like the lecture, to the basement, to the morgue, to
it's so crazy. There's no, it blew my mind, man. That changed my whole idea of filmmaking. I was like, man, Stuart Gordon made an entire film on sets with no exteriors, and none of us noticed. Nobody noticed. Yeah.
Yeah, like you say, your brain must just fill in the blanks. So just, I assume that there was like a shot, like an establishing shot of the house before we went into the basement, you know, like, because of course.
That's it. And like, even like with the university, you're like, well, I know we're in the university because we're in an office. Like, it's like, there's nothing else to tell you that we're back in the university, but you're like, there's a desk and there's some stuff on a shelf. We're back in the university. It's mental, but like, to me, it's just another sign of like, as filmmakers, we get so hung up on the rules or the things you're supposed to do, or that sometimes you look and you see how some of the greats have gone before and they haven't been bound by those rules. I remember when I made my first short, someone told me I couldn't keep dipping to black so regularly. And I was like, well, Alfred Hitchcock did it in Psycho and it was fine for him. So if it was fine for Alfred Hitchcock, I'm okay with it. But it's a habit I've gotten out of, thankfully.
Yeah, it's like you say. I mean, you know, if it's good enough for the greats, what's wrong with
it? It's worth a goal.
You mentioned a couple of times the involvement, certainly in post-production, that Fright Fest had, or your kind of discussions that you had with Fright Fest. How involved were they, and how did that relationship start with Fright Fest?
Well, I started going to Fright Fest myself personally in 2016. It was the year they were in Shepherd's Bush in London, and I just fell in love with it immediately. I went with a friend from Manchester who had been telling me to come, so that was my first year going with him. And in my first year there, I managed to piss off one of the festival directors, who would go on to become a very good friend of mine. But very first time I met him, I basically asked something along the lines of, hey, I'm wondering, did you see my short film? And which he took as, why didn't you program my short film? And then he started to give out to me, like, you know, I don't watch every short film. What do you, like, there's somebody that does that and all this. And then while he was giving out to me, my brain decided to respond to that with asking him, could I have a cigarette? Which just made him even more angry, but he did give me a cigarette. This was Paul McAvoy, by the way. And then the next day, I felt really bad, so I went up and I gave him a cigarette back. And he was like all apologetic because he just had a really bad day the day before. And so we kind of hugged and met up, and I said I'd be back next year. And when I came back in 2017, I was fit to give up filmmaking. My first film, The Three Dawns, had been such an ordeal to get made. And I kind of didn't see a site for distribution or anything like that. So I thought it was all basically worthless, to be very blunt about it. And then I was outside the Phoenix nightclub in London. And I was chatting to two of my favorite filmmakers, Adam Green and Joe Lynch, who are just wonderful guys. I love their podcast as well. It's been a huge help to me through production and post-production and everything. But I was chatting to them and I told Joe Lynch, you know, that I was giving up on filmmaking because this didn't work out. And he really told me not to give me a kick, told me, you know, look, you've made a feature film. There's not a lot of people who can actually say they've actually done that, you know, gone all the way through. And he was like, you need to go home and write something else. Like, or you know, if you don't start making something now, you'll leave it go too far and you won't be able to make something again. And so I took his advice on board, went home and started writing The Perished. So I really owe The Perished existence to Joe Lynch and Fright Fest. So yeah, and then basically went to Fright Fest again the following year, and in 20 When we went to shoot in October of 2018, I just reached out to Paul McAvoy and said, hey, look, I'm shooting my second feature, if you'd like to come on set and just have a look at what we're doing. Not as a Fright Fest connection, just as a mate, more or less. And so he did, he came and he gave some great advice on set about, you know, especially about creature stuff. And himself and John Barkin from Dread Central and Ariel Fisher from Rumorg and Fangoria and all that kind of stuff, they were also on set visiting. And the three of them really gave some helpful advice for the third act, which was, it was possibly one of the hardest sections to shoot. So they gave a lot of feedback on like, well, have you tried this? Or maybe you could do that. And I'm very open to ideas on set. I'm not somebody that's like, how dare you? I'm the director. Like I love listening to other people and taking their advice, because good ideas are good ideas. So, but yeah. And then I sent Paul the trailer in February of 2018 and or 2019. And he was like, I love this. It looks great. Do you want to reveal the trailer at Fright Fest Glasgow? And I was like, that would be amazing. So, we did that. And then I submitted and heard nothing for ages and was like, I guess it just wasn't good enough. Because Paul had told me from day one, he was like, just because I know you, if the film's rubbish, it's not getting in. And I was like, of course, I wouldn't want it any other way. But rather than that, what I got was, I got an acceptance. I got told, look, the film is in, it's been accepted, but we do have some notes that you might consider. They didn't say, like, there was no ultimatum. But it was just, and the way I looked at it was, these guys are industry vets. They watch thousands of films, you know, all the time, every year. So I was like, if I'm going to listen to anyone's feedback or notes on this, I'd listen to theirs. So between Ian, Alan and Paul, I got some great notes for the film, which really helped with tightening it up. We took it down from, as I say, I think the cut we sent to Fright Fest was an hour and 40, and we brought it down to an hour and 29. Which is only 11 minutes, but those 11 minutes really made a big difference. And people keep saying to me, oh, well, you can always put those 11 minutes back in for a director's cut. And I'm like, no, what you see now is the director's cut. I'm genuinely happy with that. And I even think that what was there before was Dragon. So, but yeah, so, and then getting to premiere at Fright Fest was genuinely since 2016 anyway, possibly even before that, because I'd always been a fan of Film for Fright Fest on TV and everything. So, but like definitely from 2016 on, the dream was to have a short or anything play there. So to get to go there and meet up with all the cast and crew and, you know, watch our film. And it was most of the casts, all the casts first time seeing the movie. So that was a pretty nerve wracking, but incredible experience.
Yeah. And how was that? What was the reaction like on the night for the world premiere, both from the cast and the audience?
It was incredible because it was like a full screen, which I was not expecting that many people to turn up. But yeah, the room was full and there was a lot of what I always love with any film at Fright Fest is that people, you can hear the reactions in the room. It's not like when you go to the cinema, the local cinema, where everybody's like shh, or you know, people don't really vocalize what they're experiencing. But like at Fright Fest, what I love is whatever people are feeling, you feel it because they make it fairly known. So like that, when there was moments of levity and people laughed, you kind of, knowing that certain parts landed, that was great to know that certain comedy beats hit. And then like that, there was a great moment where there was two jump scares that made Paul Fitzgerald, who plays David, he jumped out of his skin in the cinema, which was amazing. I'm like, you're in the movie. And he's like, yeah, it's different watching it though. But yeah, what was great for me was I was dreading what the cast, not dreading, but like you're always hopeful that the cast will like the film that you've put before them. After, as I say, it changed a lot from script to screen. So there was a little bit of me that was like, I really hope people understand why certain scenes were cut or moved. But what was great was when I talked to all the cast afterwards, they were really blown away. They were like, this was so much better than I expected it to be. And I was like, thanks. That means that helps to know that you were expecting it to be rubbish. But also, it was great that a lot of people came up to me afterwards and told me their feelings, good, bad. You know, I had people, you know, a guy came up to me and said, look, this type of film is not my thing at all. I'm not into slow burn horror, but it was really competently made and, you know, fair play. And I'd as much take that as I'd somebody coming up and saying, oh, great job, man, this was wonderful. Like, that's what I love about FryFest, is you will get honest people and honest opinions. And it's been similar with the reviews out of FryFest, gotten some incredible reviews where it seems like people really and truly get the subject matter of the film. Got a couple where people say things like, this film is clearly a woman getting punished for having an abortion. I'm like, I know it's never my place to say you didn't get the film, but you kind of didn't get the film. But that's the thing, is when you make anything like this, you have to expect that people are going to interpret it whatever way they do. And that's not up to me. I can only put it out there and then hope that they see why I made it.
Yeah. I saw in that review that you're talking about there. It's a bit confusing because it kind of says the opposite to that at the start of the review.
Like yet again, I mean, there was another review that I read that I thought got it much better, when it said, this is not saying that women should be punished for having an abortion. It's saying that in Ireland, historically, they have been. And I'm like, yeah, that's a lot more accurate, actually. Like, it's not saying that, yes, it should be done. It's saying that for, you know, 100 plus years, it has been done. And that women have been, you know, persecuted for basically being women.
Well, I have to say, I know that that type of audience do tend to be very honest. And I've not been to Fright Fest myself, but I know that genre audiences like that. I have been to Fright Fest Glasgow, and there's a horror film festival here in Edinburgh called Dead by Dawn. And I imagine the crowds are very much the same. They're very vocal and tend to know the reactions in the room. And it, like you say, it's not like being at the local multiplex.
I always find going back to the cinema, like local cinema, after Fright Fest super difficult. Like, we went to see It Chapter 2 last week, and I just wanted to be like exclaiming and clapping and cheering and laughing, and like, I'm looking around and nobody else is doing that. So I'm like, oh crap, I'm not at Fright Fest anymore. Like, I have to just sit here quietly and watch this movie for nearly 3 hours. And it's just, it's crazy, because that atmosphere can even take a mediocre film and make it good, because, you know, the atmosphere in the room. An example of that is, I'll never forget it, when I saw Rob Zombie's 31, and I love Rob Zombie, I'm a huge fan, but I wasn't. When I saw 31 at Fright Fest, everyone was cheering, everyone was clapping, everyone was getting so into it that I loved it. And then I came home and said to my wife, like, we got to watch this. I watched it at Fright Fest. I loved it. We love Devil's Rejects and House of Thousand Corpses, so we're gonna love it. And then we watched 31 at home, and I was like, oh my god, this was terrible. It just didn't survive without the audience, without the Fright Fest audience.
That is true. I've done that. I've seen things at festivals before and been like, oh, this was a great, this was a great film, and you watch it and it's not been, and like you say, you know, 31's not a good movie. I mean, like, literally the only good thing about that movie is Richard Brake.
It's Richard Brake, exactly. 100%.
That's it.
And like, if I'm being honest, he's the thing I'm most excited about Three from Hell. When I saw that he was in Three from Hell, I was like, yes, Richard Brake, the best thing about 31 is in Three from Hell. Yeah, and he was at the Fright Fest screening, and he seemed amazing. But yeah, like, as I say, I find that happens more so for big bombastic films than small. I find that often when I go to Fright Fest, when I watch smaller low-key films, they're the ones that I do end up tend to watch at home, and they're sometimes better than I thought they were at Fright Fest. A good example of that would be, I saw Josh Lobo's I Trapped the Devil at Fright Fest, and I really wanted to love it going into it because it sounded like my exact type of film. And then it was so hot in the cinema. It was a late screening. It was like 11:30 that it started, and it was roasting, and it was so, everyone was just falling asleep because it was so warm. And so I'd really struggle against all those factors to try and stay awake and watch the movie, that I ended up not really liking it. But then when I actually watched it on VOD when I got home, I was like, oh no, this is actually a really, really solid movie. So yeah, I think it can go both ways at these kind of festival events.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. And I think you're right. It is the movies that go big. It is, you know, like the kind of grindhouse tribute movies, or the kind of ones that are made in a similar vein to things like Evil Dead or whatever. can see much better, like, watching it with that type of audience.
And oh, then, definitely.
Then you come home and you maybe watch it on your TV or on your laptop or whatever, and you're like, yeah, that was so-so.
No, it's true. But yeah, as I say, I think that's all part and parcel of the festival atmosphere. But yeah, I mean, now the next step for the parish is submitting it to all the next festivals. And it's funny because you mentioned Dead by Dawn, the Edinburgh Festival just there. And that's one I've definitely have my eye on, that like I've submitted to, that I'm hopeful for, because I've had a lot of people tell me it's a really cool, fun festival. But then, I mean, the hardest thing I find with the whole festival submission process is I've learned a lot of lessons about deadlines, that like, our world premiere for the parish was August, which is not a great time to be having your world premiere, because the submission deadlines for nearly all the big October festivals are gone. So you're really moving into the next year at that point. You're kind of like, okay, I've kind of missed all the big genre festivals in October. I now start looking for kind of like everything from January on. But like, in saying that, it's just, as I say, a lesson that like, maybe for the next films, it's best off to try and get them in and done by like March, April, and start your submissions then. But yeah, it's just luck of the draw now with festivals, I guess. You just have to keep submitting and hope, because I mean...
You'd be submitting for Fright Fest Glasgow, because I know that like this year, Freaks played at both Fright Fest Glasgow and Fright Fest.
I had a curious thought about that I was like, I know that they've gone that way because they did it with Tigers Are Not Afraid the previous year as well, where they played that at Fright Fest Glasgow and they played it in London. But they always seem to do it that they play it in Glasgow and London. I don't know if they go the other way around. So I don't know if I'm able to play it in London and then back at Glasgow again. But I will say that while the parish is my number one priority at the moment and I'm pushing to get it, you know, we just signed to a sales agent and just, as I say, keep submitting to festivals and everything. At the same time, I'm not resting on my laurels, and I've started pre-production on my next film already. It's something entirely, completely different from the parish. It's a bit of an experiment, so it might never see the light of day. So we could look back at this conversation and say, remember that film you were talking about? But yeah, like, my intentions for that are that if it does turn out as I hope it will, fingers crossed, that I would like to be submitting that for Fright Fest Glasgow, or like, that's how quick of a turnaround I'm thinking here. But yeah, it's going to be a fun experiment.
So you certainly seem to be keeping yourself busy. I mean, like, you know, the parish wasn't even your only thing at Fright Fest, because you had a segment in the Hex Media's We Are the Many anthology as well.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, actually, to have, as I say, my first year with something at Fright Fest, and it was basically a short in an anthology and the parish. It was a very cool experience. And just seeing For We Are Many on the big screen as well, and seeing, like, I had only ever seen my segment, so it's very much like, you're like, I wonder how this will fit and gel into an entire feature film. So it was very cool to sit there and see all these other incredible short films. Like, some of them, I think my favorites were, there's one by Keith Robson, which was brilliant. It was like a swamp creature type of short. And then there was one by Mark Logan called Father. I'm a big fan of Mark Logan's anyway. And his short Father, which had Lawrence Harvey from The Human Centipede 2 in it, was just really weird. And I like really weird.
And what was your segment? Give us a...
Yeah, my segment is called Intervention, and it is the high-level synopsis that I keep giving is that it's basically about how possession and addiction can be confused, because it's basically, to give a very kind of brief idea, it's about a guy that has a heroin addiction, but his family believe he's possessed by a demon or a spirit, and he's kind of trying to tell everyone that, like, look, no, I'm just addicted, like, this stuff, just leave me alone. And while this is going on, there's a priest live streaming the exorcism. So it's a bit of fun. It's a bit of tongue-in-cheek. But at the same time, it is still about, like, it does still come from a place of truth, because growing up, there was a lot of relations I had that suffered with, you know, alcoholism. And for me, it felt like those people were possessed when they'd come in at 4 a.m, loud and all over the place. You were like, it was like watching The Exorcist. So, yeah, it was cool to be able to touch on yet again another kind of real-world issue.
Does this movie you're working on now also touch on any serious real-world issues?
It does, in the sense that... So it's a found footage film, which is really funny, because I always said I would never make a found footage film. I was like, I will never be one of those people that just makes a found footage film. But my intention with that was, I always thought that people made found footage films, some people made found footage films just because it was an easy way to make something. I always felt that if you were going to make a found footage film, it should be because the only way that film would work is in that format. So this one is about... The overview for it is basically a person who lost their best friend and finds an ad from somebody who claims to be able to connect with the dead, and says, you know, he has to go to this specific location to do it. And basically she says, well, if I'm going to do this, I have to be allowed to film everything, because I believe you're a hustler and you're going to try and rig everything. And so basically what it's really about, and then he turns out, you know, that he is also, the reason he wanted to communicate with the dead is because he lost his wife. So it's about how actually shared grief can bring people together. Because Stephen Tuberty, who I spoke about, who played the creature in The Perished, me and him really connected over the fact that we'd both lost people who were very close to us in the last kind of decade. And so it's something that, in a weird way, we maybe have a deeper bond over than anybody else within our circle, is because that's a feeling that when you know somebody else who's gone through it, you just have a genuine shared connection that maybe other people don't. So yeah, there's still those kind of heavy grief, straight, like, laden issues in this next thing as well.
Well, I wish you the best of luck of getting that off the ground. And with your continued festival submissions for the Perish, and if you do come to Dead by Dawn, I'm always go there just as a horror fan as well. So hopefully we can catch up there as well. But it's been great to have you on the show, Paddy.
Oh, thanks so much, Scott. And definitely, I'm seriously considering that. Like, even if the film doesn't get into Dead by Dawn, I'd like to near. I just want to go to more festivals anyway. And I will say that I've never been to Edinburgh, so that is something that I need to rectify in the next 12 months. Because, yeah, I've heard nothing but amazing things. So, got to get that sorted.
Excellent. That was my guest, Paddy, there, who I hopefully shall see at Dead by Dawn next year, and who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. That is, of course, the end of another episode. But before I let you go, I would just like to quickly remind you the best way you can support New Horror Express is to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and Radio Public. And yes, I am aware you can't do all of those things on all of those platforms, but whatever you can do would be greatly appreciated. Anyway, please also be sure to join us again in 2 weeks' time, when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror for you. Until then, though, see ya!